From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Hello. Today we're storming Capitol Hill with our homemade bread and jam as we look at the women's rights movement in Mrs. America. We're discussing what's more important, fact or fiction, in TV drama, and we're getting a little help from our friends on the Wonder Years. I'm Louise Rugendyke, and welcome to The Televisionaries. Here with me today are my fellow homemakers from The Herald and The Age newsrooms, Spectrum Deputy Editor Kylie Northover, and calling in from our LA studio is our Culture Editor-at-Large, Michael Adado. Hello.
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 How are you both?
Very good.
Very well.
Any ISO baking in sort of solidarity with the women of Mrs. America?
No, a little bit of ISO baking. I'm trying to master bread. I did discover the Monte Carlo recipe, which is on my to-do list. Arnott's have released the recipe for Monte Carlo biscuits.
Oh.
I have a cliched loaf of sourdough proving in the fridge as we speak. Kylie, what about you?
I don't do the sourdough because I've already got one child and sourdough just seems far too high maintenance.
It is. It's been the most stressful thing I've done in lockdown. Anyway, let's jump to our first show of the day. We're starting with Mrs. America, the 9-part drama on Foxtel based on the real-life fight over the Equal Rights Amendment Bill in the 1970s. Cate Blanchett plays Phyllis Schlafly, a Republican pastel nightmare from Illinois who rallied the housewives of America in opposition to the bill because she thought equal rights for women would mean goodbye Girl Scouts, hello unisex bathrooms. Standing in opposition to Phyllis and her bread-baking army are the leaders of second-wave feminism. Gloria Steinem, played by Rose Byrne, Betty Friedan, played by Tracy Ullman, and Shirley Chisholm, the first woman and black person to run for the Democratic nomination for US president, played by Uzo Aduba. For them, the bill meant a guarantee of legal rights regardless of sex, plus pay equity, strengthening of domestic violence and sexual harassment protections, and ending discrimination against pregnant people and mothers. It's a fight that's still going on today. The bill has yet to be signed into the Constitution, while Phyllis Schlafly is regarded as the founder of the modern anti-feminist movement, whose influence can still be seen among the supporters of President Donald Trump today. Before we jump in, let's have a listen to this clip where Phyllis, played by Cate Blanchett, is talking to some friends at the salon, including Alice, one of the few fictional characters in the show, played by Sarah Paulson.
You're never just a housewife. There's no more important job for a woman.
Well, tell that to the host of the dinner party we were invited to last week. He was introducing everyone at the table. Mm-hmm. Two of the wives work. One's a lawyer, one's in business. And after he introduced Buck, he skips over me completely. Doesn't even say my name. Mm. Thank you, Gloria Steinem.
The rest of them I understand, but Gloria Steinem, she's so pretty. How could she not find a husband?
Well, she doesn't want one. It's the whole point of the women's liberation movement, to be liberated from men.
I thought the point was to be liberated from housework.
Kylie, have you been liberated from housework by Phyllis and her crew?
Oh, my God, what a scary character. She's, I think Cate Blanchett plays her very well, if a little bit more glamorous. But she's obviously studied her, you know, I've watched videos too of the real Phyllis, and she's got all the speech patterns and the mannerisms down pat. Mm. But I think it's amazingly well cast. Like, it's a real ensemble piece, I think. But I also thought it's not just the Phyllis Schlafly story. I can't pronounce her name like most people in the program. It's Schlafly, two L's, isn't
it? Sorry, she does remind everyone there are two L's in it.
But it's great because you get a lot of stories of people perhaps you might, you know, everyone knows the big names perhaps, but there are a lot of side stories in the intersectionality issues that I didn't know about. For example, Shirley Chisholm, obviously first black woman elected to Congress, we all know her, but there was also the lawyer, Flo Kennedy, and Margaret Sloan Hunter, who was a very big civil rights advocate, who also worked at Ms. Magazine. I thought it was really interesting seeing all those storylines as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a fantastic history lesson. Michael, do you think we needed someone like Cate Blanchett to play such an, I mean, not quite unlikable, but sort of a real divisive character in history that, and sort of kind of be on her side?
She is unlikable.
No, I think actually it's really important because I think what Cate Blanchett does in the part is she takes a woman who sits in the history books in a place where in this, we'll call it our politically divided era, half the room will say she's a saint and half the room will say she's a villain, and neither side of the room will be interested in pulling that apart. And what Cate Blanchett does is, of course, Cate Blanchett takes a woman who half the room hates imbues her with all of her Cate Blanchettness. So as a consumer, as a viewer, I'm suddenly enchanted by Phyllis. I mean, I'm sort of, I don't like Phyllis's politics, but Cate is so charismatic that Cate makes me kind of fall in love with Phyllis. The other thing, though, is, as you guys said, I mean, this is an ensemble in an unexpected way, maybe, but also like Rose Byrne, Margot Martindale, who I love, you know, Tracy Ullman, who is just the funniest woman alive, and who actually, Kylie, you can take great sympathy. Betty Friedan couldn't say Phyllis Schlafly's name either, and it's beautiful I love that it's a gag in the show that she, and Tracy Ullman is so funny. I almost kind of felt like,
she's amazing.
I thought all those women almost stole the show. Like Rose Byrne is amazing as Gloria Steinem. And, you know, and almost in a, everybody kind of moves in a sort of paper dolls kind of way. Everything is so visually crisp. Like the wardrobe is so kind of perfect and the hair is so perfect. There is something a little odd about that. I mean, everybody does kind of walk through this in a kind of almost overproduced way, but it's still incredible. I just think, you know, I think it's one of those lessons that if you put extraordinary people into a space, what they're doing, it's thermonuclear. The thing I think is challenging about it is that, you know, on sort of one level, you know, Phyllis's kind of anti-feminism is a bit fraudulent because they think that actually she's a woman who benefits enormously from all of the hard work of the women who came her. So actually she is that kind of that really challenging figure who you kind of go, why would you choose to channel your energy against women when in fact the only reason you have all of this ability to make these changes in your world is because of the hard work of women who came before you. And I think also I get the feeling Cate herself is sort of somewhere divided between the idea that Phyllis is either an incredibly ambitious woman who kind of used this to gain greater power and she was really just interested in the power, or is Phyllis actually an ideologue who actually believes in the ideology that's supporting. And I just get the feeling from watching it that Cate probably suspects that it was really just a path to power for...
Yeah, Phyllis does come across as quite opportunistic at the beginning, isn't it? Because she's not interested in the ERA at all.
She's not interested in it at all, no.
No, she wants her... She's interested in her anti-communist speeches. But, Michael, just when you're saying that, you know, Cate really sort of owns the shot, that's one of the things I did read the directors very purposefully frame her in the middle of each shot to show that how Phyllis, you know, runs a room.
Yep.
And it's the more... The feminist characters, like Gloria, that they're all sort of lit in a much more darker way that sort of shows they're a little bit groovy compared to, you know, that's why I find fascinating watching these shows. It's much like Mad Men too. The background, the characters, the set dressing just all speak so much to the broader story as well as what they're saying.
The thing too I would say is that I certainly had absolutely no idea who she was. I wrote a piece on the show and in it I kind of referred to her as this figure who was sort of a little bit forgotten on history's page. And actually what's fascinating is when you read that, in fact, she endorsed Donald Trump as president and he went to her funeral, I'm thinking, how did I miss that in the news? Like how did, even the tiny part she played in contemporary American politics, I live in America and I'm sitting here going, I missed all of that. I somehow still didn't see the woman. And yet you kind of, when her story is kind of revealed to you, it's just stunning. It's an extraordinary story.
Kylie, were you watching this too thinking just of all the little small humiliations being wrought on women in the sort of 60s and 70s? I was just thinking, just watching about how the men were all being very hands-on with them and that, you know, at the beginning when Phyllis is at the bikini fundraising thing, though, she's referred to as Mrs. Fred Schlafly. You know, you do just kind of forget, I mean, I don't want to say how good we've got it now, but how much we've moved past where we don't have to sort of, you know, be referred to as Mrs. So-and-so, and that, you know, hopefully no one's really touching us in a lift anymore inappropriately just because they can.
I did the requisite, you know, gender studies back in the late 80s at university. So I did know of her, and I know that she did famously open all her speeches or a lot of her speeches with, I'd like to thank my husband for allowing me to come today. I felt like that she was just cynically using the women's movement to get in there. I mean, that's sort of implied in there as well. She's more interested in defence. But what I didn't know, which comes a bit later in the series, that she and the movement were, the anti-feminist movement, were responsible for G-ing up all the fundamentalist Christians into the Republican movement. Yeah, that's quite interesting. I didn't know that. That's a bit further on.
There is one other thing I would say about it, which is just in a purely television sense. I actually found it really nice. It was really refreshing to see a limited series that was legitimately a limited series that actually is just a set piece, because I feel like a limited series has become a backdoor into a regular series. Like Big Little Lies is a limited series. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but suddenly it's really popular and somehow we're going to extract a second season out of it. And I feel like that's such a cheat in television, that actually the whole purpose of a limited series is to kind of tell these sort of these 9-hour or 8-hour or 10-hour films. And actually this really legitimately does that. There's no second season. The really weird flip, because it's Cate Blanchett, which I'll throw in, is that when I watch Stateless, which is also Cate Blanchett and is also arguably a limited series, I did get to the end of that. And the first question I had was, when is season two coming? Because I was so invested in the characters. This is a historical piece, so I guess I was very willing to let it go. Well, let the chapter close on it.
Yeah, it shows a great discipline in storytelling. I was going to say, too, if you're really interested in all the characters, too, the LA Times are doing a fact check kind of every week on each character and how they line up against the series. And it is pretty much bang on so far. They said obviously a lot of the closed-door conversations can't be verified. But they said a lot of their speeches and everything else is verbatim. So, you know, they haven't done a good bit of research on what everyone's saying. Anyway, let's jump to our big question, which conveniently is about fact-checking. So at the beginning of Mrs. America, there's a small disclaimer appears at the beginning of each episode where it says, some scenes and dialogue are created for storyline purposes. But does it really matter if a show portraying historical events stretches the truth? From The Crown to Underbelly, accuracy has been sacrificed many times for drama. So in the era of fake news, should we really be surprised when something is made up on TV? Michael, does it matter if fact-based dramas are largely fiction? I mean, we're here for the drama, not the education.
Look, yes and no. I think ultimately it depends on the sell. A show like Underbelly is based on true stories, but I feel like historically never made a secret of the fact that there were blended details and embellished scenes and added dialogue, whatever it was. Mm. We shouldn't be spoon-fed everything. We do have a responsibility as consumers of information to check that the information we're consuming is valid information. At the same time, and I adore The Crown, but there is an intellectual dishonesty in The Crown, which is that essentially it's sold not just as a historical drama, but it's kind of also sold on the basis that its writer, a guy called Peter Morgan, is just astoundingly qualified to write that kind of a show. Mm. So Peter Morgan has all of this insider knowledge. So the implication in the transaction is that I'm getting all of his insider knowledge. Never mind the fact that, you know, when The Crown says that Charles and Camilla were broken up by the Queen Mother and Mountbatten colluding, that actually that didn't happen, or when The Crown shows Princess Anne kind of playing that stunt that got, you know, Princess Andrew of Greece into an interview with The Guardian, that interview never happened. So there's a sort of, there is an intellectual dishonesty, which I think as a viewer is a bit of a cheat.
Mikhaila, are you a TV fact checker? Are you Googling as soon as you're watching?
I do that. It's shocking. And I did a lot of that during The Crown as well, I must say. Mm.
Yeah.
Is it dishonesty or is it just artistic license? I mean, that's what they would say, I suppose. But I thought it was interesting in something like Mrs. America. I actually thought one of the most interesting characters was Sarah Paulson's character, who was actually a fictional one.
Mm.
I mean, I suppose she was supposed to be, you know, the everywoman character, but she got a lot more development, I guess. And I sort of, that was sort of interesting, thrown in with all these real life characters.
It's easier to move someone's journey along if they're not real.
Well, yes. Pre-Google, I remember being, as a child, probably about 12 or something, absolutely excited to see the Amityville Horror because it was based on a best-selling book which purported to be the true story of a suburban house in Amityville in Long Island in, I think, the early 70s.
Mm.
You know, and this was obviously pre-Google. So I just thought, oh, my God, this is fact.
The extraordinary thing about that film is that it's when you do dig it open, it's only sort of real. It was based on a book about a real case, but actually there is some suggestion historically that some of the elements of the case were embellished by the Lutzes. Like the Amityville Horror itself is probably a great study in the accuracy of storytelling and how history sometimes smudges it to the point that it's rendered. Yeah.
But don't they get away with it by saying there's a difference between inspired by and based on? You know, inspired by means you can just go crazy, I gather.
Yeah, so that's what Stateless says at the beginning of it
inspired
as well.
By,
they're
right.
Very careful to say it is inspired. It's not based on the Cornelia Rao story. It's inspired by. But also, Michael, is it just irresponsible, though, to just be portraying things on The Crown, you know, as fact? I mean, what do you think, apart from The Crown, I know you've mentioned, there are other shows that have been absolute shockers with their malleability with the truth.
It is a bit shit, to be frank. I mean, at the end of the day, unless the modified piece of information is so narratively superior to the truth that you feel dramatically you have to have it, there's not a lot of reason really to change, you know, details. And I think sometimes writers go down rabbit holes of thinking somehow they have to concoct something because there's this notion that television has to be hypnotic. So there's this sort of, I have to be amazed before every commercial break, or my attention span is so poor that I'll wander down the street following a balloon and forget the shows. I mean, I don't know what they think we do, but I'm like, I'm here. I mean, you've got me for 2 hours. Impress me. You don't always have to lie to me to do that.
I wouldn't watch The Crown if it was just a drama. I did get sucked in by the biopic tag.
Yeah, because it's just gossip in the end, isn't it? That's what we want to watch.
Well, that's it. We can't verify any of it.
There was a bit of interesting reportage in the UK, I remember, where the Queen apparently was a little bit peeved at some of the inaccuracies. She felt specifically, I think, what that story suggested, the suggestion that Prince Philip was an unaffectionate father to Prince Charles. Mm. She felt that was an incredibly unfair portrayal for the show to make because, in fact, the Queen's perspective, the Queen's recollection obviously is that Prince Philip was actually incredibly invested in the children and spent a huge amount of, he raised those children while she was busy being the Queen. So she felt that particular plot point was
unfair. I thought
they
refused to comment on it. So that's interesting.
Well, she didn't say anything. It was a story that was obviously placed as a kind of reaction piece, but its implication was that as an allegedly historical piece, the audience would make presumptions of accuracy, and she felt that that particular point was an unfair liberty to take with the story.
The royals didn't really need glamorising so much, but when you take so much artistic licence, something like Underbelly, like Roberta and Carl Williams really got the glow up from the Underbelly.
Incredible.
Underbelly, yeah. Didn't they? They weren't, you know, Cat Stewart did a pretty good job of, look, if I was Roberta Williams, I would have been pretty happy with my portrayal by Cat Stewart. I mean, is it fair? We're glamorising it, aren't we?
Well, no, that's television, isn't it? That's television.
But you could say that about Rose Byrne as Gloria Steinem, I think,
totally,
in Miss America. Oh, my God.
And Phyllis Schlafly is laughing all the way to the bank. She got Cate Blanchett. I mean, in the actor lottery of historical biopics, Phyllis Schlafly is like, she's the luckiest woman on earth. I mean, that's TV, isn't it? That's showbiz.
All right, great. Let's move on to game time, shall we? This week we're doing Who Am I? Right, Kylie, Michael, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay.
I was born on June 25, 1961 to my father Lawrence, who was a brickies labourer, and my homemaker mother Eva. I'm the youngest of four children who was raised on a council estate in Reading, England. At the ripe old age of 8, I stopped believing in God after being quizzed by my older brother on the subject. Anything?
The only person I know who fastidiously doesn't believe in God is Stephen Fry, who very famously said that if he ever met God, he'd have a few choice words to say to him about what a dreadful world he's built.
Oh, he's far too middle class, though, surely.
Yeah, well, so Stephen Fry's going to have company then, because he's not the only.
Oh, good, there you go. Okay, so no.
Kylie, anything?
No.
No.
Let's let those answers rest, much like my sourdough in the fridge, and let's get to the back catalogue. Let's jump into our back catalogue. Tell me what you think of these lyrics. What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Everyone knows the song. We are, of course, looking at The Wonder Years, the coming-of-age series set in the 1960s that was an after-school staple throughout the late 80s and 90s. It starred Fred Savage as a young Kevin Arnold, who was navigating his middle-class suburban life with his best friends Paul and on-again, off-again girlfriend Winnie Cooper. It won an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy in 1988 after only 6 episodes and has since been named as one of the most outstanding TV shows of all time. However, unless you buy the DVD box set, you're unlikely to see it on Australian TV again anytime soon. Before we find out why, let's have a listen to this clip where Kevin tries to ask Winnie to his parents' party with narration by Daniel Stern.
Winnie! Kevin, hi! Will I see you at my parents' party Saturday night?
Oh.
Yeah, good old Winnie.
Gee, Kevin, I'm afraid my parents already made plans.
They did?
Okay, a temporary setback. Still, with the right sales pitch.
You could come by yourself. I mean, there's going to be food and Twister. It's going to be a blast.
I don't know.
Oh, Winnie, come on. What could possibly be more fun than that?
We're marching in a vigil to end the war in Vietnam. Oh. Maybe after Christmas.
Right.
Ugh. The heartbreak. Rejection. Miley, was this on your after school list?
No, I'm afraid I'm a little bit old for that. I think I was busy watching, you know, art house cinema at that point and too cool for TV.
Yeah, it started in 1988 and went for 6 seasons.
Did it? I thought it went for a lot longer than that.
No, because they wanted to, they cut it off after the Wonder Years. They decided to, once that Fred Savage.
Actually, yeah, it was his, yeah. It was his childhood.
Yeah, right.
It is, yeah, once he got too old. One of the reasons was when Kevin and Winnie were together, the first reason they split them up was because of the difference in growth spurts. Winnie took off, Danica and McKellar grew too quickly, and so they split them up until Fred Savage caught up, and then they brought them back together so it looked okay for TV.
I actually think my mum used to watch it sort of secretly. When I'd go home, she'd often watch it because it was on at like 6:30 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah,
or,
it's a good...
It was in that slot, yeah. I always thought it was a little bit saccharine, but I, perhaps if I was younger, maybe I would have got into it. But I know that it was... You know, it covered a lot of sort of poignant topics as well, didn't I? Think the dad was a vet, wasn't he? A
Korean
War vet, and they talked about Vietnam a lot. I think my mum probably liked it because she was a baby boomer and it was all 60s. But I know that it did sort of pave the way, didn't it, for a lot of later shows with like the device of the narrator, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, Daniel Stern kind of was everything about the show, weirdly, even though he's not in it really. What, like, this is, I thought this was always like a wonderfully sentimental show. And Fred Savage playing Kevin Arnold was amazing. He was an amazing choice of a child actor. He brought great depth to it. Daniel Stern, basically, who narrates it, but narrates it as the adult Kevin reflecting on the Wonder Years of his childhood. That was the X factor for me. Cause, and I can't, even now, I'm still not 100% sure whether it was I loved Daniel Stern's voice, which I did, or whether I loved the narration device, which I also did, or whether I longed somehow, like there's something powerful about that sentiment, the idea of listening to a grown man reflect on his childhood. And Daniel Stern kind of spoke the narration in such a gentle affection in his tone that it was totally what drew me into the show. And it funnily, I mean, I feel like there's even, I'm sure, I think there's a Family Guy episode where Peter Griffin, like in his life, starts getting Daniel Stern narration and can't cope with
right.
it. And things like that. And I think actually, I think there's that fantasy, maybe on some level, maybe I did, maybe we all just want Daniel Stern to narrate our lives. It was incredible. And I think, yeah, you're right. I think that other than Ron Howard in Arrested Development, I mean, I think the two of them are maybe the two best narrations in history, you know. And Ron Howard, of course, gave us that sort of is that modern conversational trope of, you know, like, oh, you know, I love eating all my vegetables, you know, brackets, narrator, colon, he did not like eating vegetables. You know, that's very Ron Howard. But I feel like maybe Ron Howard couldn't have done Arrested Development if Daniel Stern hadn't done The Wonder Years. And I reckon if we asked Ron, that's what Ron would say, which I think is a gorgeous thing.
And, of course, it also was a great opportunity for up-and-coming actors. There were quite a lot of guest stars on the show of people who went on to become bigger actors. There was Juliette Lewis, David Schwimmer, who, of course, went on to play that horrible guy in Friends. What's his name? Ross?
Ross.
Ross Geller.
And then, of course, there's the most famous story about people starring on Wonder Years, which is an urban myth, is that Marilyn Manson played Fred Savage's best friend.
Paul Pfeiffer. I know. It was the urban myth that everyone wanted to be true, but
unfortunately. I have heard Marilyn Manson has actually commented on it somewhere. He met Fred Savage somewhere and made some joke about it, apparently.
Well, that actually brings us to the music. The music is one of the reasons that we're not going to see it on Australian screens anytime soon. Isn't that right, Michael?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, it does exist in a form that can be sold, but it's been a complicated journey. It has an incredible amount of music in it. It has a lot of music from the era. So the 60s, that music is probably the most expensive music in the industry to license because it's very iconic. The Wonder Years kind of was made probably on the last trailing edge of one contractual universe before the world technologically changed. So it was one of a whole stack of shows that had issues around the use of music, and that music has to be re-cleared, and it becomes impossible to re-clear because it would quadruple the cost of episodes because they would be loaded down with additional costs. So it just took a long time. The other really really good example, which used modern pop music, was the American remake of Queer as Folk. In that particular case, the music had only been cleared for domestic American use. So when it came time to put the show out internationally and on DVD, it had to be re-cleared, and it becomes this long, kind of costly legal process. Yes, it's an incredible thing, and it's an incredible thing to think that for a moment in time, you know, a show like The Wonder Years wavered between possibly never being seen again or surviving in a repackaged form where essentially some songs are replaced and some songs are very expensively re-cleared for use in the episodes.
Yeah, look, before we wrap up, I would say my favourite little thing I've discovered about The Wonder Years in my reading this is that David Chase, who was the creator of The Sopranos, saw towards the end of the series, I think they needed to toughen up Kevin and his storyline because he was growing up and, you know, obviously he was experiencing new things. So they asked David Chase to write a script, but because it concerned hard drug use, it never got filmed. So we've all missed out on the opportunity to see Kevin dabbling in something.
Junior Soprano.
Junior Soprano.
I will share this as well. You know, my favourite Wonder Years moment is actually Robert Picardo, who is probably best known as playing the holographic doctor in Star Trek Voyager. He actually played Coach Cutlip, who was the school football coach who really bullied Kevin. Mm. They're at the mall and Kevin discovers that Santa Claus is actually Coach Cutlip. And there's this terrifying moment where Kevin has the ability to destroy Coach Cutlip by revealing that to all the school football thugs who are hovering around the mall, and he chooses not to.
Mm.
The two arch enemies find this kind of renewed respect for each other and a love that is kind of a byproduct of this moment in the middle of a Christmas episode, which I always found impossibly sentimental and completely adorable.
I was going to say, that sounds like a very special TV moment.
Oh, cynicism. The cynicism. I refuse to believe it.
All right, look, let's move on. Before we get back to Who Am I? I know you're all on the edge of your seats. Let's have a quick look at what everyone is watching. Kylie, what's on your list this week?
I've been watching a new British series called Breeders, which it's Martin Freeman and Daisy Haggard as the parents of two kids who are sort of the anti-role model parents, not in a children's services kind of way, but in a, you know, swearing and drinking. And it's very funny, like in the sort of vein of Catastrophe, that sort of thing.
So more Catastrophe than Shameless, I hope.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah.
I was going to say it is incredibly funny, and I was fascinated to see that I thought everybody would see Breeders and think it was the funniest thing ever because I remember watching the pilot episode thinking it's the funniest thing ever. And I've seen online a few people are really offended by it. And I was quite startled. Sometimes we have really weak sensibilities and thin skin, and I just thought people just need to – it is because it's fairly bold. It's essentially about two parents who are really sometimes resentful of their parenting.
Really resentful.
And it's very funny. I seem to be on the constant search for things to take my mind off the world. So I'm actually deep in Agatha Raisin, which is a really cheesy, kind of quite light, funny mystery series. Essentially, they're based on a series of books by the author M.C. Beaton, whose real name was a lovely woman called Marion Chesney. And I actually first listened to Agatha Raisin as a radio series in which Penelope Keith played her. And the TV remake is not really like it. It's actually quite different. But Ashley Jensen, who was in Ugly Betty and Extras, is Agatha Raisin. She's really brilliantly cast. It's really, really funny. They're sort of almost, you kind of sit there sometimes going, oh, they don't even bother with these mystery plots. It's like kind of comedy Miss Marple where the plot's, you know, a bit threadbare. But the performances are hilarious and it's a lot of fun and it's very diverting. And in Australia, it was on the ABC, it was on ABC iView, and it's also on the Acorn TV streaming service.
Just quickly, I'm watching season 4 of Insecure, which has just started on Foxtel. It's a half-hour comedy that's smart, sassy, silly, and very funny. It's by Issa Rae, who stars as a version of herself, a woman in her late 20s in LA who's trying to find herself in a completely unsentimental and corny way. She raps to herself in the mirror, and she's usually aided and abetted by her best friend Molly, who is a successful wealthy lawyer. It's been called a show about regular black people being basic, and I love it. Get on it. All right, let's get back to game time, part 2. Who am I? Ready for your second set of clues, Michael and Kylie.
Hands on imaginary buzzers.
In 1980, I began studying biology at University College London, but after 2 weeks, I quickly shifted to philosophy. While at university, I met Bill McRae and formed a pop group called Siona Dancing.
Oh, Ricky Gervais.
Bingo.
Ugh. There you go.
Well done.
I had no idea.
Yes, it's Ricky Gervais. Of course, we all know him as the creator of The Office, and he season two of his new show, Afterlife, has just started on Netflix. Well done. Kylie, Michael beaten again.
Oh, I know, it's terrible. I will say this about Afterlife. I loved this first season of Afterlife. I think it's maybe one of the most beautifully sophisticated comedies I've maybe seen ever. But I was advised, I did see about 15 people on my social media channels say, oh my God, if you're in lockdown and you're alone, don't watch series two of Afterlife. Like a lot of people seem to have watched it in lockdown alone with nobody to hug. It has a great emotional wallop, but I feel like the prevailing advice is if you are locking down alone, you have to watch it at your own risk because apparently the second season packs an emotional belt.
Sounds like you need to wait until lockdown's over until you can watch that one and then give somebody a hug.
Hug a stranger, hug a teddy bear.
Okay, guys, good luck with this week's viewing and thank you for joining in. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Odato and Kylie is at Melbourne Bitter. And you can find me at Lou_Roog. You can also read stories by Michael, Kylie or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugendyke. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan and our Head of Audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.